that's the distribution functions.
Okay, so that's a really good question. And actually, there are still people who don't, even respectable people, who don't believe the anions. But there have been some experiments that were designed to find them. And I think the most straightforward thing you can think of is to take two systems with anions on the edges and try to interfere them. And it turns out that there are signatures. You have to work hard, actually, to find an anion. Why, and why is that? We talked before about STM experiments, for example. STM experiments, you tunnel electrons into your system. So when you tunnel electrons, even if you have,
a fractional statistics somewhere, even if your electron would be fractionalized to be somewhere something else, you can only tunnel an electron and extract an electron. So every probe that looks at something like that is not going to see the anions. So you have to find some indirect ways of seeing anions. And one way is to interfere them with each other. And it turns out you can do an experiment that the noise of this experiment would relate to the correlation of anions with themselves. And then you can see signature of the fractional statistics. And actually, what I'm going to say next, actually, I took almost directly from lectures by Adi Stern, and I'm going to give a link. And as he put it once, this state has many proofs, but also many disproofs. So it's still kind of controversial whether it's really seen. But I think in the past probably 3 years, there have been two experiments of this noise correlation type that are starting to convince more and more people that you have fractional statistics.
That's not exactly what I meant.
Okay.
If we have a wave function that's symmetric, that implies that we have Bose-Einstein distribution function.
Right.
Since it's symmetric, it's probably the Dirac distribution function.
Right.
So what if you have this thing that's neither,
okay,
what would be the distribution?
What do you have? You basically have your wave function. So it has electrons, let's say, 1 to n. Let's call it little n. And you also have these little flux tubes everywhere, 1 to big N. And it is the fractional statistics is that 2 pi over q or whatever phase you have there of psi of v1 vn to r1 and then ri and rj switched, let's say, rn. So just like in a fermionic system, when you switch two particles, you'll get a phase, but the phase will be pi. You get a different phase here. That's all. Actually, the switch is actually not 2 pi over q. The switch is just one switch, so it's pi over q. Okay. If I do two switches, I'll get 2 pi over q, which means that my wave function has memory of what happened to it. It knows through the phase what was the history of these things moving. And actually, so these are a billion anions. Why? Because when we exchange them, we still go back to the same eigenstate up to a phase. But they could be non-abelian. So if... I guess I can. If I have more than one ground state, so only if I have ground state degeneracy, and this is, say, psi 1, and I have also some psi, let's call it, I don't have letters anymore, psi p of the same coordinates. You could imagine also a situation in which you start with one ground state in your manifold, and you exchange two particles, and you might end up at a different state. That might be, you know, one of these states that we're writing down, or a superposition of them, because there is some degeneracy. And that is what we call a non-abelian excitation, because I could, this operation of exchanging is not just a phase, but it would be, so let's say the operator, let's call it theta of this phi, theta ij, which would just exchange ij on j, on the phase here, on the wave function that, let me just call it p, could be some psi of p prime, or if you want, I can replace it, the operator is a matrix in this p prime, psi p prime is equal to psi p. Okay, so basically, instead of e to the I something, I have a matrix. And of course, I can, this matrix could be e to the I some other matrix, so usually there would be some other, let's call it gamma, that will take me between different ground states. So it's still a unitary transformation, because all I did is just exchange particles, and I stay in the same level, so I'm still in the ground state if I started in the ground state. But now I can end up in a different ground state. And this can only happen if we have more than one ground state. So for the Laughlin wave function, for nu equals third, there's only one ground state. And therefore, at best, we can get anions that are abelian. It turns out that in other circumstances, we can get non-abelian anions. And now, let me take a little step back and try to look at the problem from a different angle. And I mentioned before, when we did the Laughlin wave function, that there's a mapping. Mappings and analogies are pretty powerful tools in physics. And often people that skip from one field to another make huge progress just because they have more imagination, or they have more insight from a different problem that they bring. And another angle that I want to, point of view that I want to take on the problem of the fractional quantum Hall effect is the following. Let's say that I have a Hamiltonian, whatever Hamiltonian it is. I can describe it always as some matrix. So let's say this is a matrix element, and in a Hilbert space that I define like that. I can always do a unitary transformation, since I can always write, if I have a unitary transformation, I can always put unity here. Let me dagger you. Psi n. Which means that I can call this h tilde, and the new states chi. So it's just a basis change, right? So I can always do a basis change. And one such transformation is called the Chern-Simons transformation, which is basically u is e to the I sum over all of the particles ij, all of the pairs, times the argument of zi minus zj. So it's like, it's the angle. So let's say the argument of a vector is just the angle. Okay, so if this is z1 minus z2, theta is the argument. And I want to multiply here, let's put it before, by some number, phi tilde. This is a unitary transformation. It's a gauge transformation. It's a singular one. So it leads to maybe some complicated mathematical properties, but we're just going to use it to get some intuition. And basically, what it does for us, you can think of it in a different way. If all we did was multiply our wave functions by this kind of a phase, I can think of it as just adding some gauge field to the problem. So I had psi go to this e to the I something, let's call it A Chern-Simons psi, and I can just write the Hamiltonian as going from, which was before just P minus EA squared over 2m, going to, under this transformation, to P minus EA minus some other gauge field. Let's just forget about E to make things easier. We can always multiply and divide by E. So we just have an additional gauge field, but it's not a uniform, its curl is not a uniform magnetic field. So curl dot A is just something else. It's some function of space, the space, basically. So we added another gauge field, and the gauge field is actually given by, it's not just a function of space that I know. It's a function of space that depends on where the electrons are. So if I really wanted to solve this problem, I had to do it self-consistently. Okay, I would have to arrange the system in some way, calculate the gauge, and then I'll have a new Hamiltonian. I have to do it again and again until things will match, kind of. But instead, I don't want to do that. I want to do the following. I want to say the following. The effective Hamiltonian, well, let me see if I have the signs right, actually. Let's say I have it here. The effective Hamiltonian here, the effective magnetic field here is the curl of A minus A, and is basically, basically the curl of this. But now I want to do something that we did before. I want to do mean field. So in that context, what I want to do is take the gauge field and average over position, so it's going to be some n of r. So basically, whatever density I had that gave me this kind of mean field, that gave me this kind of effective field, I want to just evenly spread it. So effectively, I have reduced or increased, depending on what I chose, the field that I have. So effectively, I have the B that I had before minus curl A, which is some density, some average density. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually what I want to write here actually is this prefactor that I have times phi naught times some average density. Okay? And why is that? You can think of this as basically adding another flux. Now, if you look at this, it looks like what I did is I added, it's similar to the addition of Zi minus Z J that we had before to just add a flux in the system. But here I just added more than one flux. I added phi tilde fluxes. And I only added it because I wanted a unitary transformation. I only added the phase. So I didn't really put in the Z's. I just put their phases. And it looks like on every particle that I had, I added phi tilde fluxes. And now I'm just smearing them. So for so on average, how much flux do I have? I have phi tilde times the flux quantum, which I added to each electron, times the number of electrons. Okay? So this is a funny transformation. And basically, it's also referred to as composite fermion theory. Because what I did here is I took, in this transformation, I took an electron and made it into a bundle of an electron and phi tilde flux quantas. But why will I do that? I do that if I want to get some effective field that I like better than the effective field I started with. For example, if my effective field was such that the filling was fractional, I can try to get an integer filling via this transformation. So what would be the filling? The filling is basically B, I have to add the area here. Area, okay? Because this is in units of flux, and then this would be the original flux. Yeah, sorry about that. It would be the original flux here. Okay, so now I have many phis. This is the flux in the system due to the physical magnetic field. This is the flux in the system per electron given by the transformation, and this is the number of electrons. Okay, I guess if I multiplied by area, then this is the number of electrons. Otherwise, it will be electrons divided by area. So it's all the same. But what is my effective filling now? So the effective filling would be basically this, 1 over this, right? The effective filling, yeah, so the effective filling becomes, I just need to take the flux and divide by the flux quantum, and 1 over that. So let me maybe remind you what we say mu was. I'm going to leave this. So nu was how many electrons we have per lambda level degeneracy, which was this number divided by the area times the area divided by 2 pi lb squared. So if you want to work this out a little bit, you have 2 pi, lb squared is h bar over eb. And we have the area here, and we have the number here, which gave us h over e here. And the flux here, one of the flux. So we had basically n times the flux quantum over the flux. This was the filling. This was mu. Yeah, so that makes sense. So the number of particles is how much of the Landau level is full times the filling of the Landau level, which would be, the number of states in the Landau level, which is phi over phi naught. So that makes sense. And if you plug this in, you find that nu effective is basically your, to minus 1, is basically your original nu minus phi tilde. Sorry, minus one here. Okay? So, for example, if my nu was third, then I could put a 3 here. I can put a 3 here. And if I choose 2, then I will get that my nu effective is 1. So this is when started with a third and attached two fluxes. So I get an effective state that is 1. Now I have to say that we didn't do anything in terms of solving the problem. All we did is transform it to another problem. But if we know how to solve this other problem, then we're good. The trouble is, we don't know if this is indeed the ground state. So when Laughlin wrote his wave function, there's one thing to show that this is a good eigenstate, but another is to show that it's really a ground state. And that is determined by energetics. And this transformation does not tell us what the energetics are. But once you do this transformation and you get to a state, it gives you a handle on describing the state. Or if you want, this could give us a pointer in which direction to look for interest rate and ground states. But then we have to do the energetics, compare the ground state that we get in one case to other suggested competing ground states. So what does it mean that we got nu equals 1? It means that we started with fractional filling of electrons. But in terms of the composite particles, we actually have a full Landau level. So we'd expect, if we have a full Landau level of a certain type, that we will have a plateau in our sigma xy. And basically, we also know in this case, we already calculated what is the charge of every flux tube. And the charge of every flux tube was E over 3. So we had 2 E over 3 and an electron. So that's minus E over 3. So the composite fermion in this case actually has charge E over 3. However, it's still a fermion, and because it's not just a flux tube. So in terms of statistics, you can work it out and see that you're actually getting the 2 pi when you exchange the particle, one particle around another, the composite particles. You can just add up the phases you get. You have one electron giving you pi, and then two. What's quanta? Actually, I don't know if it works. Okay, forget it. But anyways, the intuition that this gives us is that we have a full Landau level, composite fermion. We have a state that is analogous to the integer quantum Hall effect in terms that the sigma xx is 0, the sigma xy is not, dissipationless currents, and all of that. So it's good for that, but we already knew how to do the nu equals third. But what the Laughlin wave functions didn't help us do is even denominator fractions. And actually, in the experiments, there are even denominator fractions. And if we take an even denominator, we can actually cancel the magnetic field completely. So let's say, so our effective flux would be the flux we started with, minus this times phi naught times n. Now, what I want to do is just take this to be 2. And let me first say that phi is also 2. because if nu is equal to, then I know that that n phi naught over phi is 2. So phi is n phi naught. So phi over phi naught is 2. Yeah. Yeah, so phi is 2. Yeah, yeah. So what I want to say is the following. Phi is equal to, nu is half. That's what confused me. So nu is half. So basically phi is n phi naught times 2, which is exactly what I have here. So the effective flux, this is 2n phi naught. So the effective flux is 0. So basically, when I have an even denominator, and it doesn't have to be a half, I can map it onto a problem with no magnetic field. If I have, say, 5 halves, which is a popular state because it happens to be something that can be seen in experiment and also very interesting, I can forget about the 2 full Landau levels and just do this treatment for the partially full Landau level. Just take the 2 here and we're good. And now, after we map this, what do we get? So the analogy we made is that we have now some composite particles, but we know more or less what they behave like, because we know they're Hamiltonian. They are just free particles that interact with each other but don't feel any magnetic field. So we have a system that we know and love. So what can it do? It can do different things. And interesting fractions were half, 3 halves, 5 halves, and 7 halves. The Chern-Simons transformation took us to a state with B equals 0 and composite fermions. And interactions are still there. Maybe just I should comment that this transformation that we did, you get the additional gauge field in the kinetic term. So let me, maybe I'll just write it here for a second. So p squared over 2m, even if there was an a here, plus v of r. In the transformation, all we did is multiplied on the 2 sides by e to the I phi Chern-Simons and e to the I phi Chern-Simons. And because of the derivatives here, we got p minus a plus little a, but v of r didn't change. So we still have the same interactions we had before, no matter what it was. And that we can't do anything about, but we can take the magnetic field to 0. So once we do that, we get a system that we know, and it can have roughly 3 states, roughly. So the first state is that when the interactions can be taken perturbatively and don't change the state much, and maybe renormalize parameters, and you basically stay in a Fermi liquid. So still, I think if you want to characterize that by symmetries, for example, there would be no broken symmetry. Still a liquid state, no preferred direction, no order. If you do want to break the translational symmetry, or reduce it, because you have, say, lattice symmetry, you want to reduce it, you get into CdW, which I call it, it's a charge density wave. So charge density wave is usually something that is characterized by anisotropic transport, for example. So just imagine that for some reason my system wants to have modulation of charge in some direction. So say the x density of charge is modulated, but in the y direction it could be actually the same as before, just invariant. So I will have a different conductivity if I go in the x direction or the y direction. So that's a charge density wave. Or I could have a superconductor. So these are, all of them are interesting states. It turns out that three halves, so let me write it here, three halves, nine halves and higher, so higher halves, are all in that category of a Fermi liquid. So that in terms of conductivity, you just see conductivity. It has, the transport is dissipated like any Fermi liquid. So sigma xx. The charge density wave, let me see if I know of an example actually of which one is a charge density wave. Oh, sorry, yeah. I was mistaken. The nine halves is charge density wave. So nine halves and others are charge density wave. And five halves and seven halves are superconductors. So I didn't say yet anything about the superconductor. So I think you spoke a little bit about superconductors in John's course. And I'm going to talk a little more about it actually in the end of next week. But all I want to say about a superconductor is that it has dissipationless current or dissipationless transport. But we already saw dissipationless transport in the edges of the quantum Hall system. So this is actually also a quantum Hall. So in our analogy, whenever we find that our Fermi liquid actually is unstable and creates superconductivity, we actually have a quantum Hall system. And the dissipationless transport that we usually have in a superconductor is because we have a big gap from the ground state to the next excited state, and this is what we have in the quantum Hall effect too, in the integer quantum Hall effect. So this is kind of analogous to the integer quantum Hall effect. But unlike an insulator, when the large gap is between something that doesn't conduct anything to something else, in a superconductor, the ground state itself is conducting, and even conducting without dissipation, and this is what happens in a quantum Hall system. On the edges, you have dissipationless current. Okay, so after we did that transformation, and since it's singular, we cannot go back. After we did that, we can just play with the wave function of the composite fermions. And then, for a superconductor, for a Fermi liquid, it's just, you know, a Fermi liquid. It's just single particle states for the composite fermions. For the charge density wave, it's some ordered state, but you can approach it maybe in mean field. For the superconductor, it's the Bogliubov wave function.
But well, I simply thinking of the wave function that is analogous to Laffer wave function for all those.
Oh,
functions.
Okay.
This is
so the reason, right? So Laughlin's magic worked for the odd 1/q states, but it doesn't work for the half states. Yeah.
So, but in principle, the wave function, of course, exists.
Yeah.
All the four such states too, although it doesn't have any resemblance to Laughlin wave function.
I don't know if it really exists.
Oh. Okay.
In the sense that we know of a closed form for it.
Yeah, this is what I'm asking.
No. I mean, all we know to do is to treat the composite fermions as our particles, and then since we know the problem of Fermi liquids and their instabilities, we can write down wave functions for that. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's only after we already translated to some other to go back to describe it in terms of electrons will mean to undo the singular gauge transformation.
So, this is what was observed experimentally, and essentially the wave functions were constructed to the basic experimental evidence.
Yeah.
Purely phenomenological.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so what you can do is numerically you say, okay, so this gave me basically a guess of what the ground state would be like. I can write it and do some variational analysis. Mm-hmm. Or I can do it and compare it. I don't know if it's going to be a charge density wave or a superconductor. I can write the two wave functions and just simply calculate the energies. Mm-hmm. So this you can always do. Just compare energies. So we're kind of shooting in the dark here because we don't have, a good way to do perturbation theory. I mean, after you do the transformation, you can do many things with the interactions. You can do many things. But now, I promised you before that the anions do not have to be abelian. That they don't have to just commute. So it happens that in certain kinds of superconductors, there will be very special excitations, which I call Majorana, which their exchange will mean that we go to another ground state. I don't want to say too much because I really want to talk about it in the end, but let me say the following. So a superconductor, I think you touched that a little bit, is in mean field. So this is just aside, I want to talk about superconductivity. In mean field, a superconductor looks like that. It has some kinetic energy. And it has a pairing, some kind of a pairing term, which would be given by, let me just use the same, will be given by delta k, ck, c minus k, dagger, dagger, plus delta k star, ck, c minus k. Now, what I didn't write here is the spin. And there are different kinds of superconductor. So first of all, there are singlet and triplet superconductors, meaning that if this is a function that is even or odd under exchange due to spin, okay? So if the spin state here is even or odd, and the whole thing should be odd, then this will be also an odd function. If this is even, this should be an odd function. So when you talked about superconductivity in John's course, I think you discussed S-wave superconductors. These are the most common ones. And this is where the spins are in a singlet state. So you can just write up, down, for example, here. And then this function is actually an even function under rotation, which would it becomes the orbital function. It's just more or less constant along the Fermi surface. You also talked about D-wave. D-wave is also a singlet superconductor. So it also, you see that these are angular momentum. Basically, you can expand this function in terms of angular momentum, because there's no momentum here. There's k and minus k, but there is angular momentum. So d wave has angular momentum 1. So this has 0, s wave. This has 1, which means that as you go around the Fermi surface, it will actually acquire a phase 2 pi. So it goes from, let's say, delta to be minus delta, to be delta again, to be minus delta. Okay? But there could also be a P wave superconductor. So that's on the other side of triplet superconductivity. There could be a P wave. And a P wave is a state that when you circle, so this is L equals 2, sorry. This is the even angular momentum. So here L equals 1, and you see that here I actually acquired 4 pi, right? Because I got into the same state after half the circle. So this is for D wave. Now, if I do the same for a P wave, maybe I'll do it here next to it. So this is D wave. If I do the same for a P wave, if I start with some delta here, I'm going to get I delta here. And I'm going to get minus delta here and minus I delta here. So the phase of this thing actually winds by only 2 pi, not 4 pi like here. So you always wind by 2 pi times L. And I think you saw by discussing the D wave superconductivity that you have in high TC that its form and its properties are very different from S wave. For example, it has nodes where there are zero energy particles. This is even more peculiar since we have a complex order parameter. And if you imagine it being on a square lattice, there would be bonds where the order parameter is actually imaginary on the bond. And it turns out, and we'll talk about this next week, that there are special excitations on a certain P wave system. So if you take a P wave superconductor and you put a vortex in it, again, actually piercing a magnetic field through it, you'll find that there's a state that's bound to the vortex. And that state gives us the non-abelian statistics. So remember, we said before that we have a manifold. We sometimes have a manifold of ground states. So let's do gamma of whatever, you know, particles we have. So in P wave superconductivity, we'll actually we'll have the usual particles, but we'll also have, so it doesn't have to be the same number. So we'll also have these states in the vortex cores of the P wave superconductor. And when we exchange, we're going to end up, say we start with one of these manifolds. When we exchange, we end up with another member of the manifold or a combination of members in the manifold. So this is what we mean by non-abelian statistics, that the phase, that the exchange can be described by a matrix acting in the subspace of the ground states.
And the position of the vortex cores?
Yes, exactly. So in the P wave superconductor, it's the positions of the vortex cores. In a general construction, like in nu equals third case, it was, again, the position of where we added these flux tubes. So in a superconductor, actually, a flux tube is a vortex. It's the same thing. So we have the flux tubes, but in the K case of nu equals third, we only had one wave function. So if we wanted to stay in the ground state, we had to go back to the same wave function, and the only freedom we had is a phase. Now we have more freedom. We can go to a different member of the manifold and acquire some phase. So so that's what we call non-abelian statistics. If you think about it, if we really had a D-wave superconductor, a P-wave superconductor, this is P, we can always thread fluxes relatively easily, because it's enough that we apply a uniform magnetic field. If it's strong enough, the superconductor likes to actually have vortices instead of just letting all of the flux in. This is called the mixed state. So the Meissner state is when all of the flux is expelled. The normal state would be when the superconductor gives in and just let all of the flux go through it, and then it's not superconductor anymore. Or the mixed state is when we have these places, these vortices, where inside the vortex core there's no superconductivity, but there is all around it. So it's kind of a compromise that the superconductor does to accommodate the field. So to create vortices is pretty easy. And then the question is, can we manipulate them? If we manipulate them, we can do these switches and see non-abelian statistics. And that actually has been proposed as one way of doing quantum computations. Because you can think of these unitary transformation and quantum computations are always actually representing some operation, some computation that you do on your state. Start with a state, you multiply it by unitary matrix. And you know, you can do a quantum computation by multiplying by many matrices, and in the end, the function you get is the result of this computation, if you want. So we're going to leave the quantum Hall effect for now, and then look into topological insulators. But this dream of actually getting non-abelian statistics and these objects actually in a P-wave superconductor are Majorana fermions, which I'm going to mention also there. So this is in the quantum Hall effect. This is one proposal on how to get these Majorana fermions. We're going to see in topological insulators that there's maybe another way to get something that's analogous to a P-wave superconductor, which has Majorana modes. I guess this is all I want to say about that at this point. And this would be also a good point to ask whether you have questions about anything we've covered so far. Yeah?
Can I ask about a brilliant question from earlier? So are you saying it's more complicated than, so with fermions and bosons, you can quite easily work out the distribution function by considering possible occupation numbers. But here you're saying you have to switch states when you do exchange, so it's not so easy.
To see the statistics, I have to switch states.
So it's a more complicated object.
I guess with fermions and bosons, you have a direct consequence, which is either Pauli exclusion principle or Bose-Einstein condensation. Here you don't. Yeah, so you have to somehow get to that, and it's not simple.
Suppose you have, say, a Laughlin wave function. How to do
thermodynamics? Oh, okay. So Laughlin did us a big favor on the one hand, because he gave us the ground state.
Yes.
On the other hand, since there was no method of deriving that, we don't know the whole spectrum. He did show that these anions are probably the lowest lying excitations. So if you wanted to do thermodynamics at low energy, what you should average over are these anions, basically. And you can imagine that maybe it's not as simple as averaging over fermionic something. But, and I, honestly, I don't really know how to do it, but it would be some kind of thermal averaging.
The thermal, I agree. So simply I can't imagine where the temperature would enter. So in this construction.
Yeah, yeah, and it's very confusing, and also in for the case of the these Majorana fermions that arise as in a P-wave superconductor, we call them excitations, but actually they carry no energy. So there's no point in asking whether they're occupied or not. They just exist as in the ground state. So once you add the flux, the new ground state has that Majorana fermion at the vortex core. Mm-hmm. And you can do all kinds of manipulations, but it's not like you excited. It's not like you, you know, added some energy to the system by warming up and you got these excitations. It's not really an excitation. It's all at zero energy.
Yeah. What happened, for example, if you study the effect in the theory, that situation? Will you be able to derive like further excitations in the
heat? Yeah, yeah. And people, this is what people do. I don't do that. It's totally out of my line of research. But yeah, basically, this is what people do. They write effective field theories to deal with that.
As Bob Laughlin liked to say himself, quantum field theory adds nothing.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. It's the only handle we have. Yeah. But he's quite an interesting guy, so I'm sure he said many interesting things. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not here tomorrow, but Monday, feel free to drop by if you want to ask something.